was transforming musical linguistic objects.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Well, it's been 2 weeks now, I guess, since my last podcast, but my guess is that you've been as busy as I've been lately and that you probably wouldn't have had time to listen to another podcast anyway. How's that for rationalization, huh? But there are some fellow saloners who found the time to make a donation to the salon, and so I want to thank Matthew N., Carl R., and Andy H. for their generous donations. And I also want to correct a thank you from my last podcast in which I mispronounced one of our donors' names. And that kind soul is Jared S., who I mistakenly called Jarrett. Sorry about that, Jared. And thank you, Matthew, Carl, and Andy, for your continuing support. And speaking of support, today's program once again features Bruce Damer, whose development team at DigitalSpace.com created the virtual reality training simulations that the NASA crew used to train for the recently completed Hubble Telescope repair mission. And if you go to DigitalSpace.com, you'll see a link on the front page to the spacewalk simulation, and you can go through some of the training yourself. And I might add that if you are a VR developer yourself, well, that site is also where you can download Digital Space's DSS, which is the open source 3D platform that Bruce and company built to use in developing this application. And since it's open source, you can also use it for free. So thank you, Bruce and friends. Anyway, when the Hubble mission flooded the news this week, I somehow remembered a couple of Bruce Damer's talks that may be of interest to you. The first talk I want to play is one that Bruce gave in 2004, and in it there were several stretches where he showed a short video, and I had to cut those out because without the images to go along with Bruce's commentary, it just didn't work very well. Which means that this talk isn't as long as it was in its original form, but I think there is an important message here, particularly for any of our fellow saloners who might be feeling a little bit overwhelmed and stressed out with information overload. So I'm going to play that right now, and then I've got another short conversation with Bruce that I'd like to play for you. But right now, here is the second talk that Bruce Damer gave at the Mind States Conference that was held in Oaxaca, Mexico, during the month of September 2004.
What we're going to do is that the subject of this talk is really very close to the work that Galen and I do, and that the company, we have 16 people in our company, and we're kind of a ragtag group, work around the world, and we do a lot of projects, and the projects are all out of the edge of cognition. We seem to be getting hired all the time to do work at the boundaries of the ability of the human mind to function. And extending those boundaries. And for example, one of the boundaries is what type of human mind? One of the scary properties of modern life is something known as kind of cognitive overload. And you probably, all of you probably experienced it. It's just one too many emails, one too many calls from your teenage kid that's in trouble again, and one too many harassing comments by boss or something, and your brain gets to this sort of mush phase. And this is a property that's pretty rare in primate development and primate history to reach that phase. In fact, if you go to forests in Africa, you find that the smart primates didn't get cell phones, or in the forest they stuff themselves on something and then they lie around for 2 days. You know, bonobos, and you know, who's really smart here? Anyway, so primates spend a lot of time in their history sort of lying around and recuperating and picking, getting extra protein by finding bugs and insects on each other and things like that. And so, in a sense, we're in a weird state. All of humanity is in this bizarre state where we're subjecting our cognitive processes to things that guys, I can't talk if you're talking. Thanks. See what I mean? Anyway, we're subjecting ourselves to something that hasn't happened to our species ever before, which is pushing our limit, our brain's capacity to the limit and beyond. And there's, you know, one would think, oh, that's a great thing, you know, expand your consciousness and be able to do more email, you know, and more instant messaging and more texting. But there's a huge social, societal price we're going to pay for this. And I think most, you know, with due respect to most academics, people who research, they're about 5 to 10 years behind current trends. So by the time we start to study this stuff, it'll be endemic throughout society. Back at the farm, and if you're ever in Northern California, please come and visit us. I have a barn, we have a barn, and it's full of 600 vintage computers. And they all work. And they're from 1973, and it documents the history of the beginnings of personal computing and digital community networks, whatever, everything, Cray supercomputers and Altairs and Altos and all, you know, from the various garages in Silicon Valley. And it's to document the invention and the culture that came out from the personal computer and then the network. And, you know, in a sense, you can go and look back then and you can say, oh, it's 1979, and the only people in the world who were sitting in front of a computer with a graphical display and doing email were people at Xerox PARC and a few other places. And they were living in that future. And you go back and talk to them, and they kind of invented that lifestyle. And they never thought that a billion people would be doing that. Maybe 2 billion people on cell phones doing that in a similar interface that they invented. They couldn't have conceived of it. So what all of this is coming to is a sort of a giant unplanned experiment that you're all part of. And what I'd like to do is to sort of show you two snippets of work that we do at the company. The first one, I'll just explain this before you start it. No, let it go. This is astronaut training visualization for Johnson Space Center. So I'll let these guys talk a little bit. What they're doing is they're training for one of the most dangerous and important missions in NASA's history coming up in the spring to replace a giant 600-pound gyro part that has gone bad on the station. If they can't replace it, the station could end up with no ability to control its attitude to move itself around. And so these guys have been training for a couple of years, or, you know, year and a half, in the swimming pool in Houston called the Neutral Buoyancy Lab. And these guys, there's one guy whose feet are on this robot arm, and he's just bringing down the broken gyro to the guy who's now going to attach it to something on the shuttle cargo bay. Then they have to go over and unscrew the replacement gyro and stick it on the station, cable it up, spin it up, and see if it works. They don't know what caused the broken gyro to grind to a halt. It was grinding and vibrating for 24 hours before it failed. And so basically, these guys are in a highly challenged cognitive environment. They have 6 or 7 voice channels into their suit. They have 6 degrees of freedom. They're moving. They have so many things can go wrong. The sun's rising and setting, and they're doing this procedure for 11 hours. It's like 11-hour brain surgery. And what happens on spacewalks like this is, and we do a 3D reconstruction from the swimming pool training in order so that they can sit in front of a computer and see it from another perspective and put themselves on the, make themselves into the gyro. What is the gyro seeing as I'm moving? When does the sun rise and set? Because when the sun rises, it blinds you. So if you're in the middle of undoing a fastener or something, you can't see something. These guys tend to get cognitively overloaded and they get brain fuzzy after about 3 hours if they're intensely communicating or whatever. Maybe if they're 13 years old, they could do the whole procedure straight through, but these guys are in their 40s and 50s, and so their thresholds are getting lower and lower and lower. Give you an example, the Mir space station, which was almost lost when the Progress supply ship was coming out. You remember this? And it slammed into the station, it bounced off a module, and the module seal was breached and started to depressurize. Well, the commander said, you know, I looked up at the monitor and there it was, and then I looked back and it was gone. It wasn't there, because he was seeing it come in. It was an automatic docking of this. And what he was in a total cognitive overload. He was in total fatigue. And he blacked out. His brain just, he went into a stasis for about 10 seconds, a critical 10 seconds. He was overloaded, brain stopped working. Blacked out, unconscious of it, but still sitting there, came back, and then the ship was, you know, they were in the middle of an emergency. So that's exactly what, where human beings can go. If our technology around us and our social demands, that's the condition that you can put somebody in. So it's absolutely not his fault. I mean, of course, it's like, Valentin, why did you do this? And like, I don't know how to answer that. Because they had driven him so hard that he stopped functioning. He broke as a part. And every one of you in your offices at work or whatever, you're kind of getting up to that threshold now and then, and maybe going into that threshold. And one of the things I was so fascinated by this, because we work in the area of trying to help people deal with this, was what causes that cognitive overload, and what in a very simple model of the brain. And then we're reading an article by Damasio, some of his new work, who many of you know is a brain researcher. And he wrote this article. It was like a total revelation to me. It's kind of like Alan's talk yesterday morning. It was a big revelation to me on where did my creativity go. You know, well, I'm writing federal contracts. That's why it's not. That little valve is completely stuck open, and nothing's going through the creativity side anymore. But except these talks, perhaps. Damasio seems to be showing, and this is something. We have friends in a clinical acupuncture practice in New York City, and they kept telling us, and his name is Mark and Warner Seam, and Mark wrote, probably was responsible more than anybody else bringing Chinese acupuncture to the U.S. and writing about it and westernizing it. And he said, you know, that our practice, we're starting to get all these people whose adrenal systems are shot, who come in, and the only thing that they can get is a nervous system reboot. So we give them, you know, pretty deep acupuncture, try to restart them. And a lot of them, it turns out, a lot of Orthodox Jews, including rabbis and whatnot, who are so wired and stressed out that they've all gone into to go to acupuncture. And I started reading up about this, and it turns out that there's this whole booming field of clinical diagnosis of something called adrenal exhaustion, where people are tripped out on interrupts. And so, for instance, they come in the morning, and you know what I'm talking about, and they start getting email, and they go, great, I'm feeling great, that's emails coming in, I exist, therefore I get email, therefore I exist, etc., etc. And there's stimulus response, Pavlov's dog, right, this, that I exist. And what is happening is their eyes are darting around on a screen, and they're sitting totally still, and their eyes are darting around. Now they're doing rapid eye movement, and those darting of the eyes are driving the adrenal system to pump out a little bit of adrenaline. Because if you're a primate in the wild and there's a cheetah stalking, you're doing like this, and that is driving your adrenal system to get ready to run. If something is out there. Now, if you're sitting in an office doing this, you're getting a wonderful high, but your body's not moving. It's all piling up in your body. And you hit a crash, like 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you dump. So where do you go? You go to Starbucks, you know, or somebody brings you coffee to pump it up again. And this continual cycle, and then you're in traffic on the way home, and nothing seems real. You know, it's like, nothing seems real. And you don't know what's happening to you. And you go home, you have a fight with your spouse, but you don't even remember the fight because nothing seems real. What's happening? Well, you're not really feeling much. Now, Damasio is powering all his research onto this area. And there, what he's finding is that, or what he's claiming is that there's sort of a two-speed brain. One part of your brain is the millisecond responsive cognitive part of the brain. Just bang, bang, hey, I got that email back. Go fast. And I can handle all this stuff. I can text like this, and You know, and your brain is has a hunger for this stuff, this cognitive rapid response stuff, and if you're proud, and it can just do things so quickly. And then there's another part of the brain that does the emotional processing. And it turns out that the access to either store an emotional sense or retrieve it and use it is very slow. It's like seconds or even minutes. The cognitive part is like, bam, bam. Now, we're probably evolved to be that way. You know, we're sitting around in our primate community and somebody hits somebody else and everyone goes, oh, you know, then they have to digest that. But if suddenly a troop of monkeys appears and a scout appears and they're going to steal all the food and start hammering you, and they each have to do something, boom, they're reacting. Like, quickly, you go over there. You know, so that the two functions that we had to supply to survive. So what Damasio is showing is that people who, in the lab, who get a huge amount of cognitive stimulus all the time start to have no access to the emotional part at all. They can't store to it and they can't retreat from it. They become what he calls emotionally neutral. Now, it's a very innocuous term, but it's a very scary scary result. Because if you become emotionally neutral and you're driving home in your big SUV and you run over somebody, you'll just keep driving. If you're head of a company, right, and it's like you're frazzled and you have no connection to your emotions, and it's like, we need to lay off 10,000 people, you just all do it. You know, like, that satisfies my cognitive need to get a better result for the analysts who are hammering me, and I'm just a numbers guy anyway. Let those 10,000 people go. No emotional connections. If you're a president of a country and it's like, let's saturation bomb this area. Yeah, let's do it. We see it on the screen and we see that, yeah, see that blob of blue stuff? Well, that'll all be red stuff and we'll be okay. No emotional connection. Big danger for humanity here. Now, of course, there's another interesting on the spectrum, and Galen will run this next piece, just sort of diverging back to the other part of our work. What if you're a little kid, and what if you have autism? Let's actually show you this game. And what if you don't even understand what a street is, or what a street crossing is? What if a room like this, full of people like you, would put you into immediate overload where you freeze? What if a house that you're sitting in is on fire and it starts to burn down and you freeze because the flames and smoke are too much information? A child with autism often reaches this cognitive overload threshold like that, just bang. But what was discovered by Dorothy Strickland a few years back, several other people we've worked with her, and Gail's worked with her for years, is that these kids in a computer game like this, they'll fixate. This is a perfect world for them. They'll look at this dog buddy's face, they'll follow the instructions, they'll listen to the voice and the songs, and they'll move around in a world, and they're profoundly autistic, and they'll use the cursor keys, and they'll learn things. And because an autistic child is not necessarily low IQ, they'll also try to break the game and trick the game. But here we have buddies saying, come on, let's follow me, I'm going to show you how to cross the street. And Gail's not playing this, but behind it, this is a soundtrack of continual stimulating sound that many of you heard when you came in. So you get the idea. And these children sit down in front of these games, and they build a mental model of the world that you're gonna have to push the mute button. And they build a mental model of the world, because for them, being in front of a computer screen isn't necessarily a big cognitive stimulation that they're going to do 1,000 instant messages. For them, it's a way to understand the world. So, as with any powerful tool, this digital technology and immersive virtual worlds, which are like drug trips, let's face it, and they do immerse people, I call it a double-edged broadsword. It's so powerful it can cut your head off, or you could use it to go across a creek practically. This environment is so powerful. Because unlike just instant messaging and telephones, you're totally visually enveloped in these environments. even if it's just on a small computer screen. So she's looking left, right, and left to, good job. And now she can cross. And they're gonna cross. So if she tries to go outside the lines, it'll throw her right back onto the sidewalk in kind of a nice way. Never run into the road. Now you still have to look left, right, and left. So these kids will go through this game hundreds of times. They'll initially try to break it, and then they'll try to do it. They'll actually try to make it, and then they get rewards at the end. There's the reward. So whether it's an astronaut who's trying to keep from making such an incredible mistake on orbit that, like slamming a control moment gyro against the U.S. lab, which would be not only a big embarrassment and a career terminator for them, but it would cause other things. People be killed and things like that. But they're also trying to, we're trying to help these autistic kids get overwhelmed with data to build models and actually function in the first place in the world. And I think it would be interesting to show you. You have to turn the sound back up a bit. One of the things that people keep mentioning here is they keep mentioning Burning Man. And truthfully, Larry Harvey talks about regional burns and models for changing all of humanity. But to my mind, Burning Man is like 80% about people trying to come to a place where they reconnect with the emotional part of themselves, the creative part of themselves, because they're so suffering and they're so desiccated in the outside world and their jobs from that. And they need to come to a place that maybe isn't acupuncture that does a nervous system reboot, but they need a place to get sane again or try to find their way back to where they thought they were when they were humans. And that's really what Burning Man is about. And maybe Burning Man, and if they can take some of that back, some of that rebalancing back into their lives, they can affect the world. But unfortunately, I think Burning Man is a symptom of the disease. It's not necessarily if the whole planet was Burning Man, of course, we need, thousands of more Walmarts to supply these people because there's no ability. If Burning Man was 500,000 people and actually was in the entire Black Rock Desert, it would be one of the most egregiously consuming entities and leave the mountains of trash you can't imagine because it's just an unsustainable community. But it's a tremendous place to try to walk back to becoming a human being again. And this year we found that there was very little art on the fly, and I think that's possibly due to the funding regime now that exists for art projects, which being in the federal procurement system, what you're starting to see is people competing for dollars to get their art out there. And to build a big piece, you get more. How do they measure it? And it's not that they're burning up their own capital, their own cells. They're actually getting funded to do things. And of course, things are good that they're doing, but there's conspicuous absence, like 90% absence of art. Large pieces. Strange. And the man was very underwhelming in terms of its structure. It was a good theme, but the temple, David Best's temple, you saw a couple pictures of yesterday, was tremendous. It was possibly the best one yet, I think. So, in a sense, maybe Burning Man is us trying sort of well-off nerds from the Western Hemisphere or Western world trying to reconnect with something that's very old. And Terence talked about sort of new, what did he call it, new primitive or new tribal. And that's kind of a theme as people sort of grow from that. But in a sense, as humanity is really being stretched here, and it's almost as if a certain proportion of humanity becomes fully emotionally neutral. It's like every vision of every science fiction cyberpunk come true, because you've got, there would be Neuromancer jacked into the metaverse, or, Orwell's 1984, and people are just sort of drones. And there's no emotional life. And that can be achieved through this giant cognitive driving factor. And you can probably sense it in your cells, and I think it not only, if you don't have access to the emotional part, the emotional mechanism, you can't be creative. I really believe that. One of the things that Damasio gives as an example of this is he says, if you are in a state of emotional neutrality and you call someone on the phone, and you're going to ask them for a favor, and they start to say, you know, I'm having a terrible day, blah, 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 and this is what's happened to me, and whatever. A person who's kind of present, what they do, what he claims people do is they do simulations. You become that person just for an instant. You simulate them in your own body, your own emotional state of mind. And then you have what's called an intuitive flash about whether you should ask them for that favor now or not. So if you don't have the doors open and you can't simulate, i.e. you have no empathy for other people, you can't simulate, you have no intuition. And you have no intuition with social intuition. And you're joining the continuum of autism in some sense, because everything is going to be about data and driving your goals and whatever. You're kind of a cognitive autist at that point. And you'll just talk right over top of people. You don't hear what people are saying. And, you know, talk about being difficult to raise a family, being difficult just to function. And in a sense, people who are also over-mediated, who are not only in this cognitively overstimulated state where they're losing emotional connection, but they're watching so much TV. And the TV and the reality TV is becoming their lives. They're using reality-based TV to create temporary simulations in themselves so that they feel something. Like, is she going to get the guy? Or, you know, is they going to get, you know, it's like, yeah, is Trump going to hire them? And they feel all wrapped up in it, but it's being substituted for their own ability to do that. Because we're story machines, and if we have a story being told, we're willing to throw away our complete person and adopt that story. But when the story's over and the TV's off after 6 or 8 hours a day or whatever, you're left pretty empty from that experience. So it's what's interesting is, you know, this conference is about mind states, but I think what you could do is look at the mind states out there that everybody's in. They're in an altered mind state. You know, what is a non-altered mind state? But I think that you could say that a hunking big proportion of society is in an altered mind state that's actually could be clinically diagnosable. And they're popping Xanax or whatever they're popping, Prozac, I mean, they're medicating themselves, they're mediating themselves, and trying to keep their sense that, am I still here, kind of thing. So everybody's in a mind state that may be, and in a sense, we talk about saving the planet and whatnot, you can't even start to think about it until you solve this problem. Now, of course, the thing that can alter the mind state is, well, maybe even not. If there's an incoming asteroid, people would not really connect with that emotionally. Like, okay, you know, don't see it now. You know, maybe it's just a TV show. You know, would that wake people up? Would housing price crash and half the country be out on the street in foreclosures and bank failures? And that wake people up? It might. Would it be global climate change? I mean, just physical discomfort for primates would probably wake them up. What you tend to find, and this is also in Damasio's work, is that a person has become emotionally neutral and they're just motoring along on their cognitive stimulation. When they have an accident or something, when their loved one dies, they have no buffer. It tends to either, they don't know, they have no connection with it, and the family members can't understand, or they plunge headlong into a complete breakdown. Because now they're overwhelmed with something in front of them that is undeniable. Now they've lost their cognitive state just goes bluey, and they're now, in a sense, in an unprepared emotional state. They've not been using that mechanism for a long time. And suddenly they're sunk into it, and they will crash. That's not good either. And so I think, I mean, is this a very positive view of the thing? But it's all part of the giant unplanned experiment. And I think, I'm just trying to think of what I was going to conclude with. I was supposed to say something positive. Anyway, psychedelics, yeah, there we go. So when you can go to Brain Man, you can go get acupuncture from the beams, you can, from the seams, you can do a lot of things, and in psychedelic state, perhaps what you're doing is you're simply, because you're putting your entire self aside and allowing yourself to be filled with something else. And it may be the use of psychedelics may be the most powerful antidote to this growing critical problem for primates, the primate brain. So perhaps, you know, if there is some kind of, you know, where does society go from here? What if 3/4 of the American population is emotionally neutral and they're driving, and there's a breakdown? Well, maybe one of the solutions is the kinds of things that, say, the Shulgins are evolving, the Pioneer, or you guys are evolving. Maybe that's the only way back from this abyss. So just another kind of perspective. On the overall mind states of the entire planet right now. That's why it's so nice to come to Mexico, because fewer people are in this state. So why don't we open it up to questions, comments, criticisms?
I guess my comment is that as a psychedelic user and as someone who is involved in certain communities that are smaller, I find it more difficult still to relate. It's even more difficult because I've used psychedelics or because I've joined up with these communities, more difficult to relate to that 3/4 of the percent of the population that's still within this mind state of disassociation. And I'm wondering how Burning Man or something like the Moon Tribe or something like the Mind States, I mean, I think that's why I'm here, and I'm wondering how other people can relate to this. Is how is this essentially helping us? Because what it's doing is it's creating these small semi-urban or quasi-urban tribes, which allow us to kind of express ourselves under these small micro kind of environments, but really still hyper disassociate ourselves from, you know, the rest of society. And although that may be healthy, I don't want to necessarily be integrated into reality TV. At least for myself, and I can't speak for everybody else here, is that, you know, I was hoping that psychedelics would help me integrate better into a larger sense of society, that I could communicate with more people instead of fewer people. And as much as I'd like to embrace my freedom, I think that part of embracing that is also to disassociate yourself with a greater sense. You know, and I feel like that's the great danger here. That's the great danger of things like Burning Man or Moon Tribe or Mind States. And as much as I love all of it and love all of you, you know, it presents a danger for us if we can become really inclusive and insular. And then kind of think everything's all right, but you still gotta wake up in the morning. Most of us do still have to wake up in the morning to go to work and figure out, how am I gonna relate to that guy who wants to talk to me about the last episode of Friends? You know, when I just had this like seriously dope experience in the middle of the desert, how am I gonna really do that? And I'm interested here, instead of necessarily talking, and don't get me wrong, Burning Man is a great thing, because it's a great thing, my fix is a great thing. How are we trying to communicate with the rest of the people? You know, I we can no longer maintain this kind of, like you said, unsustainable
economy
of psychedelics and just
my sense about this whole thing is that there's going to be some huge crisis in the next decades, and a lot of people are going to be dumped into a very confused, and you know, the old models will be discredited and people will be really hurting. And I think that if you guys can build yourselves up and the loving energy that you have and the insights that you have, and get ready to help some people, because we're all going to hit the wall. But the people who are caught, who are in the state of wired into all that media and all that cognitive dissonance, are going to, the plunge for them is going to be very far. And I think it's just, it may not happen in our lifetimes, but it might.
I'm concerned about competition among primates. Project yourself back, let's say, 10 years ago, and let's say you were going to enter the same field you did, but with current technology today. Do you think you could compete and be successful without having to immerse yourself in all the email and interactive structure?
Yeah, you know what I have this morning. I'll have to tell you some guys something personally. I'm the principal investigator on a giant proposal for NASA, and I wrote an email to these people. I said to our prime, well, it's Raytheon and people like that, and I said, guys, the reporting requirements are so brutal for this thing. You know, monthly, I mean, full cost accounting monthly reports. Okay, the whole thing, and we have two universities and two giant companies and three NASA centers that I, in my exuberance, signed up for this proposal. And I said, this is going to kill me. And can somebody else lead this thing? We would be very happy to be a little supportive role, but I, even if I can find the best contract manager, and if any of you can do this, anybody know what GNA means? Raise their hand, please. But the truth of the matter is I'm probably going to back out, and I'm going to say, I will sub to anybody, but I don't want the responsibility. It will kill me. And all you guys will get paid your salaries, and I'll be a piece of jello at the end of this thing. And I won't have painted a picture, or you know, Gail won't be able to reach me at all, because I'll be doing back-to-back reports every day. And yes, we may go back to the moon, but I'll be probably dead from the process. So anyway, that's a decision you have to make, actually, is how much you take on.
And the rest of the story is that Bruce has now disbanded his team of VR creators and is pursuing his PhD and the Evo Grid. In fact, in early August, Bruce and I plan to get together for some more brainstorming, and one of the things we plan on doing is to record another interview for The Salon, and that will be when we'll get an update on what Bruce is currently focusing on, namely the Evo Grid. But since the talk we just heard got shortened due to my cutting out the bits where he had shown a couple of videos, I thought I would slip in a little bit of a conversation that Bruce and I had back in 2006. I'm only going to play a little bit of this late-night conversation, but I think that a few of the things that Bruce was talking about are even more relevant today. And keep in mind that when this conversation took place, little Georgie Bush was still in the White House, which brings me back to my mother's mantra that everything has changed, but nothing is different. And now I'd like to invite you to join Bruce and me for a little late-night discussion.
So in strategizing, because people, even if people aren't really paying close attention, I think people are sensing something coming in the form of a correction of some kind. Do you see different strategies for people in different age groups, or is there a generic overview that people need to be thinking of?
Well, I think that every time I go to Costco or Trader Joe's and I get all these lovely products and I come back and everything, and I think I just have this deep sense that this can't go on. One, it's a gift. It's a tremendous thing in joy. It's like, this is tremendous. That all these products come and they're perfect and they're priced well. And, you know, how can we conceive of a planet, you know, 50 years like this? And it's really hard to say where the correction will come. But a correction can come in many ways. And I think the correction is already happening. And the correction is happening, the initial cracks are psychological. It's the stand on Zanzibar book cover that you see from 1968, where all those people are in those little cubby holes. Mm-hmm. In their own little world of, this is my reality, and I'm afraid of that next cubbyhole that person is. And there's 7 billion people crowded on the planet, and there'll be more soon. But it's these realities where everything becomes cultish. You know, every group lives in an existing cult, and they don't even have to be in Jonestown, and next to the poison Kool-Aid. They just have to be next to their media stream that reinforces their memetics for that cult belief, and gradually going crazy. They don't have to be in the mansion, you know, in the Heaven's Gate mansion. They don't have to be there. They can be anywhere and be in that cult. And whether they're extreme Islam or extreme Christianity or fearful, you know, left-wing liberals who are often even the most extreme and radical of all of them, and harder to work with and deal with, because there's no fun and no humor in them. They're apocalyptic, you know, not in the Christian sense, but the extreme left are the ultimate sort of harbingers of the apocalypse.
But they don't have any common sense, and they have no traditions to fall back on. You know, apocalypse right. management traditions. So in a sense, it's the correction, the preconditions for the correction are the slow madness of the population, especially in the United States. It's way ahead of this game. If you went to southern Italy into a little town on the coast, you wouldn't find this kind of madness. You'd find a little bit of it, but basically people living the way they were. But as soon as you go to the Anglo-Saxon countries, insane people. And the native peoples, there was a comment by one of the chiefs in New England, I don't know who made it, was they saw the French coming, they thought, oh, they're kind of cool guys, and Italian explorers, oh, they're, hi, how you doing? And then the Anglo-Saxon showed up. It was like, they took one look at these people's faces and they thought, big trouble with these people. They are miserable. They are never going to be satisfied with anything. There's something wrong with these people. Mm. They just knew it. Like, these are bad dudes. And is it the Anglo-Saxon brain? But of course, you have Beslan in Moscow and the paranoia. And the paranoia is sort of cultural. So Russian paranoia, you know, is intense. But they've always been in it. But you have a European, the new European paranoia. How's the European madness factor now? The European madness factor in 1939 was pretty intense. You know, and they blew it out of themselves in 6 years and decided they didn't want to go back there. But certainly Yugoslavia was an expression of that madness factor. Africa's always, you know, the land of genocide, and it was for 5 million years. And probably always will be, you know, but how is it doing in all these places? And yet, you know, when we went to Southeast Asia, you're sitting there in Singapore and you're looking out at all these beautiful glass towers and this perfect society that has beaten all the culture out of itself. And they know that. But one of the things you look out at, you look at Thailand, you look at Vietnam, which was, you know, the state Vietnam was in, and you say, wait a minute, we're watching the Southeast Asian Games and they're in Hanoi. There's this brand new stadium, there's a laser light show, and all the countries from Southeast Asia are in Hanoi doing this high-tech, their own local regional games, except for Burma. And you realize they've come a long way. Jeez, they've come a long way. And then you go to Bangkok. I went with my friend from the Peace Corps who lives there part of the year, and he took us to the spot in Bangkok where the border, where the end of Bangkok was in 1972. He says, this is where Bangkok ended. Now we'll drive 2 hours to get to the current edge of Bangkok where I have funded an elementary school and I have a little apartment above the school. And this is how much Bangkok has grown. You know, it's 8-10 times the size that it was. And you see how, despite that, they've stayed ahead and they have cleaner water and better schools. And the king basically has managed. He said, we need to improve a certain percentage a year in every category. We don't have to make big jumps. Mm-hmm. And that whole region, how much better off it is. So the positivity is, there's so many incredibly positive things all ramping up at the same time as this kind of mania, at the same time as the consumption of all the resources and the transformation of the gas state of the atmosphere. You know, and getting ready for some really interesting climate that we haven't seen in a while. I mean, I read somewhere that, you know, we worry about Katrina, but South Florida, like Tampa Bay and all those sorts of things in the Okefenokee itself, carved by super hurricanes.
Yeah.
You know, that whole coastline. And you're looking at something with a 80-foot storm surge that is taking the top 40 feet of soil off. And the thing is channeling through South Florida, and kind of runs out of steam, but that's the violence of it. So you're looking at a 230-240 mile an hour hurricanes, and those are 15,000 years ago or 8,000 years ago, but we've had a nice calm weather period for a long time, and we think Katrina's bad.
It's just a harbinger of things to come.
Yeah, and when you put that much energy more into the atmosphere and you shift things around, and it's almost like the party is over. You know, here's all your fossil fuels, burn them up. You know, here's a nice, stable climate period, And maybe our CO2 emissions are preventing another cooling period. But, you know, here's optimal everything. You know, we'll give you everything. Planet will give you everything it's got. All the forests and all the, you know, it'll allow you to genetically engineer all your crops and produce the Green Revolution in the 70s, which prevented mass starvation. You know, but it's all of this stuff at once where women have fewer kids, so the population growth rate is slowing. That's a good sign. You know, but China's burning billions of tons of coal in the atmosphere. That's a bad sign. So all of this, and then you have the internet, you have open flows of communication. Good sign. The internet carries manic, crazy, paranoid belief systems to local groups that become radicalized. That's a bad sign. So it's like everything. So what is the correction? I think the correction is an intensification of all those things at once to some kind of a breaking point or a series of breaking points, or a breaking point that triggers a mass psychological effect. So, you know, that's a very common theme in science fiction. So if you explore this, you know, what could make people sort of go bonkers and do mm-hmm. bad things? Nazi Germany was a good example. You know, people, a system was manipulated, a paranoid population, a fearful population who had good reason to be afraid, manipulated them into doing really, you know, very rapidly.
Right.
Doing an incredible, amazing job at producing a lot of material and getting a booming economy going and getting a military class rebuilt at the same time strategically, and then creating a pogrom and creating a kind of blind following of a leadership that was going to take you right over the precipice.
Right.
And I don't think that'll ever happen in the U.S. because the U.S. is so diverse. You know, you'll have Santa Cruz will break off and, you know, it's so diverse. But I think that, in a sense, that the it's hard to really see the correction. If it's an asteroid strike, I mean, that's sort of an easy one. If it's just gradually being, the correction probably is we find it harder decade after decade to produce enough food, or we just find things just don't work as well. Mm-hmm. Things just start to break apart.
Well, the infrastructure is already starting to crumble in many places in this country, even.
Right, although, on the other hand, they're building all new infrastructure. Mm-hmm. But I think we come to the point where, gee, that those wonderful years of stable energy prices, which we're really dependent on, now we have these huge surges and drops. We have, say, the Saudi oil production wiped out by insurgency. Suddenly there's a massive economic chaos. So we have economic chaoses that the world experienced in the past that we haven't for a while. And the former Soviet Union was an example of maybe what can happen when an entire system breaks down. You go to the former Soviet Union and you find guarded compounds with wealthy people in them and incredibly crumbled infrastructure in a lot of places and a falling down, but you have a rising up at the same time. Or South Africa, where you have high-tech booming economy in some sectors, and the other sectors it's massive corruption and a breaking down of the idea of government. And they're all competing for each other. Like, can you win before we win the other way? Or can, it's almost like, can we win against a global pandemic, bird flu, before it comes for us? And so I almost see like there's these two forces coming up together, like hands coming together, and one of them's getting a little bit ahead, and one of them, and you get higher and higher and higher, and you have a smaller margin for error. Everything now is very high up, and the stakes are very, very high up. So a slight pushing to one side or another, and something breaks apart. But it's very hard to see where it'll come from. But the psychology of people to deal with the crisis, that's the real thing. Do you have level-headed, objective-thinking people? Like, for instance, if you had in the abstract, if you had an asteroid coming in, 500 or 200 mile or 20 mile across, none of the people who are currently in government or currently probably running agencies of any kind are suitable for dealing with that crisis. And ultimately, but of course, they won't relinquish their jobs,
right.
But they're not suitable. You need an utterly different kind of person to get that job done. You know, so if any crisis arises, you have the wrong people, probably, because the things that put them there and the constituencies that wanted them there create a person that's incapable of handling a real crisis. And so you're never going to be able to say, gee, okay, we've got a real job to do now, step aside, we're going to find the best people in society. It won't happen, so the crisis won't get handled. So it'll be, if it's a asteroid strike, which it probably won't be, but if it was a medical, you know, a pandemic, you know, the system will fail us, our leadership will fail us, it's like Katrina, but on a large scale. And I think that's where you have the correction, because nature gives you a certain amount of time to react. Say if it's a pandemic, you have weeks to really do it the right way. You didn't react. The stakes are already very high, and you just lost a third of your population. And now there's no one to maintain highways anymore, because it killed just a third of the maintenance guys, and they count for more than you do. They kept the sewers running. So it really is going to come down to leadership. The second aspect is if you have a radicalized population that's very paranoid, they can be led, they can be misled very easily.
Right.
And so in that circumstance, and this is what happened in Nazi Germany, a radicalized population, guy can step right into that and then truly create damage. So I think in a sense that the correction may come from, you know, this utter failure of leadership to respond to crisis, because they can't, and then instead of drawing in a strong, powerful leader that is also fair and whatnot, get you through it, you get failure of the system, and then a true radical step. And George Bush and company are not these people. They're not the true dangerous people. Those people are yet to come. They're maybe kids right now, or they're in their teens, but the truly dangerous individuals are out there. And one of the things, in a subsequent podcast, I can tell you more about how you deal with those kinds of people, because it's been something that I've made a practice of trying to sense those people's presence. Because people who have truly caught the whole, they've caught the energy thing, that their charisma, we talk about Terence McKenna's charisma and other people, where they've taken charisma and they've turned it, you know, not to, you know, artistic means or whatever other means, they've turned it into true manipulation, true psychotic manipulation. You know those people when they're in your presence. And I've got this kind of empathic sense in me that I can pick them up. And I can't keep them out. So they come, whatever they have comes in, even if they don't notice I'm there. And I've noticed that these types of individuals. And so you've got to know who these people are for real.
I was going to say, that sounds like part of the strategy is being careful who you listen to and really evaluating what your leaders are saying and make your own decisions, don't be swayed.
Yeah, and if you want a future, you have to take charge of your own thoughts. And if you're having thoughts about, you know, I hate these people or I'm afraid of that, and other people, would you want everyone in the world, including the people who are actually running your sewer system, or people who are running your local government, to have the same thought in their head? You'd say, no, I don't want people to be having the thoughts like I do. It would be terrible. It would be terrible if everybody was in the state of mind I'm in. Nothing would get done. And you don't want that. But yet, maybe other people are in that state of mind. What are they going to do? People with positions of influence having that kind of state of mind that you have?
Well, that's the advice. Take charge of your own thoughts. And because you can sort through your own thoughts if you really put the effort in.
It's almost like when you're in an airplane and the next passenger over from you is drunk and asleep, and there's a person there who's all frantic about some business deal, and it's like a microcosm of humanity in a big jumbo jet. You're flying across the Pacific, and everybody hopes and believes that the pilot and the co-pilot are there, they're sensible, they're reasonable and rational.
Not like those two guys.
Not like every other passenger.
Yeah.
And even the service staff are like, someone's pissed off at somebody, and it's like this crazy mad thing going on. And then there's two sensible people talking, but you think that the pilot, they're not having crazy thoughts, or they're not drinking, or they're not, you know, and you hope, but how can you completely expect that?
Right.
And if all of the passengers are nuts, maybe some of the pilots are going to be nuts. I mean, how can they insulate them? Who's insulating them and protecting them? So if they're our leadership, you know, who's watching over the leadership to say, we don't want people who are nuts in any way to be our leaders. No one's watching over that. People are just, if everybody's nuts, they're going to put nuts into leadership.
Yeah.
And then the whole aircraft is coming down somewhere.
Coming down.
So, yeah, it's, you know, in the first online community, the phrase was, you own your own words. If you type something and put it in, you own it. And it goes out to people and it hurts somebody or whatever, you own it. And you really own your own thoughts, too. Because every thought you have that is unpleasant or whatever, or untrusting or fearful, goes into the ether and becomes part of the whole picture.
You become what you think about.
You become what you think about. And so anyway, we'll leave it there.
You're listening to the Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
And I guess I should say once again that it's been about 3 years since that conversation took place, and so maybe we'll pick back up on some of these topics this summer when we record another late night talk about. Again, I'm going to have to cut my own remarks a bit short today, and I'll tell you why in just a minute, but first there are a couple of other quick things that I'd like to mention. One is the fact that while many of our fellow saloners lament the fact that they feel as if they're all alone out there at the far edges of the tribe, it doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of psychedelic people nearby. You just haven't found them yet. And keep in mind the wording here. As Terence often said, find the others, which implies that it is up to you to find the others. You can't wait for them to find you. Now, I don't have any better ideas about how to go about doing that than you might have, but just to give you an idea of what I would consider an out-of-the-way place to find the others came in a brief note that I received on Facebook. It was from Carl S. and read, "Hey Lorenzo, I love the Psychedelic Salon. It's my favorite podcast to listen to on my bike ride to work here in Shanghai, China. Keep up the good work." So, let's face it, if there is a psychonaut in Shanghai, there's gotta be one in your neck of the woods, too. On another note, you'll probably recall that in my last podcast, I mentioned that Arrowhead is trying to raise the funds necessary to scan more than a dozen boxes of documents from the Myron Stolaroff archive. So far, that effort has received a little over $100 from a couple of our fellow saloners, and on behalf of the Stolaroffs, I want to thank you. In fact, I'm going to make a quick run up to Lone Pine to see Myron and Jean this weekend, and I'll report back to you about that visit in my next podcast. Which reminds me that I need to let you know about my schedule for the next few weeks. As you know, I'm in the final stages of recording my new novel as an audiobook. And to be honest, that project is considerably more time-consuming than I anticipated. But, hey, it's always that way, isn't it? Anyway, I'm going to have to cut back for a couple of weeks on doing these podcasts. So my next program will come out on June 3rd, and that will be followed on June 10th with my fourth anniversary podcast. Yep, that's right. It will have been 4 years since you and I first started getting together here in the salon. And for my June 10th podcast, I'm going to play the first chapter of my novel. Hopefully, I'll also have the rest of the book recorded and available for purchase online. But the first chapter is already complete, recorded, edited, and even if the rest of the book isn't quite ready yet, I'll definitely podcast that first chapter on that day. My idea, of course, is that if the first chapter doesn't grab you enough to spend $12 to hear the rest of it, well, you just saved yourself a few bucks. It's sort of my version of try before you buy. And once I've got that project tied up, I'll be back on the forums. Right now, I only have time to visit the growreport.com forums a couple of times a week, and then mainly as a lurker. But I plan on getting back in the loop soon, and the same goes for Facebook, email, and the phone. I can't even allow myself to think about how many little things are slipping through the cracks right now while I'm in this writing vortex. But I'll eventually get back to the default world, so please don't give up on me. But even if you aren't hearing back from me, I want you to know that I truly appreciate the cards, emails, and music you've been sending. I do read them and listen to the music, which is excellent, by the way. So, until the 3rd of June, I hope you are able to ease into the summer months or the winter months for BB, Hermit Girl, and the rest of our fellow Salonners down under. We are living in some interesting and exciting times, and I hope that all of the interest and excitement in your life is all positive and fun. Well, that's it for today, and so I'll close by reminding you that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are freely available for you to use in your own audio projects under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at psychedelicsalon.org. And that's also where you'll find the program notes for these podcasts. So for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.